Orion Magazine hosts regular dialogues with writers, artists, activists, and thinkers about transforming ideas into action for people and planet. These events are free and open to all Orion readers and friends. Today we bring you another such conversation. Dialogues like this are made possible by your donations, so please go to orionmagazine.org/donate to support Orion in bringing readers, writers, and activists together in this way. Thank you.
Welcome to Orion Magazine's discussion of Confessions of a Recovering Environmentalist with Paul Kingsnorth, Leara Keith, and David Abram. Thanks for joining us. This is Eric Hoffner, Outreach Coordinator for Orion. This event is the latest in a series of monthly dialogues with authors, thinkers, and activists that inform and inspire the entire Orion community. Log in with your computer now if you haven't already done so to see the slideshow. If you prefer to just listen, that's fine too. After our guests share their thoughts, we'll open it up to your questions. Email your own to events@orionmagazine.org. You can also use the chat box on your computer screen to send a question, but please keep it as brief as you can. So, Paul Kingsnorth, he's been writing about environmental issues for 15 years and is a former deputy editor of the renowned UK publication, The Ecologist. In 2009, he co-founded the Dark Mountain Project, cultural and creative response to this age of ecocide, as he calls it. He lives in Cumbria in northern England. Leara Keith is a writer, small farmer, and radical feminist activist. She's the author of two novels, as well as The Vegetarian Myth, Food Justice and Sustainability, and she's co-author with Derek Jensen and Eric McBay of Deep Green Resistance, Strategy to Save the Planet. And David Abram, he's a cultural ecologist and philosopher who lectures and teaches widely. He's the author, most recently, of Becoming Animal, An Earthly Cosmology, as well as The Spell of the Sensuous. David's writings have received various honors and awards, including the Lannan Literary Award, and he lives with his two children in the foothills of the Southern Rockies. So, Paul, your story in the current issue of Orion, Confessions of a Recovering Environmentalist, has received a lot of attention and stirred a lively debate in the forum attached to it at our site. Would you mind starting our discussion of it today with a short reading from the piece and then sharing your further thoughts?
Yes, I will. Thank you, Eric, and thanks for inviting me onto this call. It's a great thing to be doing. There's been a great discussion around this piece, so I'm really glad to be able to continue it here. Yeah, let me just start then by reading a few paragraphs from the article, which I hope sum up some of the key points. I became an environmentalist because of a strong emotional reaction to wild places and the other than human world, to beech trees and hedgerows and pounding waterfalls, to songbirds and sunsets, to the flying fish in the Java Sea and the canopy of the rainforest at dusk when the gibbons come to the waterside to feed. From that reaction came a feeling, which became a series of thoughts, that such things are precious for their own sake, that they are food for the human soul, and that they need people to speak for them to and defend them from other people, because they cannot speak our language, and we have forgotten how to speak theirs, and because we are killing them to feed ourselves, and we know it, and we care about it sometimes, but we do it anyway, because we're hungry, or we've persuaded ourselves that we are. But these are not, I think, very common views today. Today's environmentalism is as much a victim of the contemporary cult of utility as every other aspect of our lives, from science to education. We are not environmentalists now because we have an emotional reaction to the wild world. Most of us wouldn't even know where to find it. We're environmentalists now in order to promote something called sustainability. What does this curious plastic word mean? It does not mean defending the non-human world from the ever-expanding empire of Homo sapiens sapiens, though some of its adherents like to pretend it does, even to themselves. It means sustaining human civilization at the comfort level that the world's rich people, us, feel is their right, without destroying the natural capital or the resource base that is needed to do so. It is, in other words, an entirely human-centered piece of politicking disguised as concern for the planet. In a very short time, just over a decade, this worldview has become all pervasive. It's voiced by the President of the USA, and the president of the Anglo-Dutch Shell, and many people in between. The success of environmentalism has been total, at the price of its soul. The environment is the victim of the human empire, but the environment, that distancing word, that empty concept, does not exist. It is the air, the waters, the creatures we make homeless or lifeless in flocks and legions, and it is us too. We are it, we are in it and of it, we make it and live it, we are fruit and soil and tree, and the things done to the roots and the leaves come back to us. We make ourselves slaves to make ourselves free, and when the shackles start to rub, we confidently predict the emergence of new, more comfortable designs. I don't have any answers, if by answers we mean political systems, better machines, means of engineering some grand shift in consciousness. All I have is a personal conviction built on those feelings, those responses, that goes back to the moors of northern England and the rivers of southern Borneo, that something big is being missed, that we are both hollow men and stuffed men, and that we will keep stuffing ourselves until the food runs out. And if outside the dining room door we have made a wasteland and called it necessity, then at least we will know we are not to blame, because we are never to blame, because we are the humans. So that's a couple of paragraphs from what is a very long piece, and quite a divisive piece, I think, and I think deliberately so as well. This is an essay that I wrote after about 15 years of being an environmental activist, being an activist on the front lines, also working for NGOs, writing about green issues, trying to think this stuff through, and seeing the green movement change in that time, and also coming to the conclusion, and it was a very difficult conclusion to admit to myself, but I think a lot of people are starting to admit it to themselves now, coming to the conclusion that a lot of the problems that we're facing can't be solved in the sense that we would like to solve them. For example, we're not going to stop climate changing. We're not going to stop the mass extinction event that we're in at the moment. Hopefully we can prevent it from getting any worse than it has to get, but we're in it and it's happening and it's too late to do a lot of things about it. And meanwhile, the green movement, which I suppose sprang to life in the 60s as a very radical challenge to the industrial system, and which presented a very different way of looking at the world, the most radical new idea, I suppose, for hundreds of years, really, more radical than anything Marx came up with, in my view, is this thing that we might call ecocentrism, which is that our value systems should encompass the world beyond the human. They should encompass life itself, rather than simply the interests of those of our species. It's a very difficult thing to put into practice, but it is a very good thing to aim for. And that was what the environment movement was aiming for when it came into being. And it was also aiming to really wind back much of the damage done by the industrial system. But over the last 30 or 40 years, environmentalism has been probably inevitably sucked into that system. And two things, briefly two things in particular, I think, have happened that have bothered me, and I think which have really neutered the radical challenge of environmentalism. Firstly, it's been sucked in by the market. And if you listen to a lot of environmentalists now in the mainstream, and obviously I'm generalizing here in this essay and in this call, when I talk about environmentalism, I'm really talking about the kind of popular environmentalism that you'll hear from the NGOs and the green parties and the media figures and the people who have influence in government and business. But environmentalism has become a market now. It's become a carbon market. It's become a technological way to make a huge amount of money trying to stop climate change or invent new trees that will suck the carbon from the air and put the wind farms all over the mountains and all the rest of it. And that has become what we call sustainability, which again was originally a radical word and has now become a word which seems to mean sustaining industrial civilization through the use of technologies which don't emit carbon. And is no kind of radical challenge at all. So that's the first problem. The second one, I think, is that the Greens have allowed themselves to be identified with the political left far too much. And the political left's job, its historic challenge, is human equality and the fair distribution of resources. And my point is not that those are bad things, but that they're very different things from the original Green idea of bringing about a challenge that looks more widely than simply at human interest. And because the Greens have allowed themselves to be dominated by the left, if you like, I find that the original ecocentric narrative, the beyond human narrative, has almost completely disappeared. And what we end up with, again, as I say, in the mainstream, is a kind of bleached out environmentalism, which isn't really much of a challenge to anything. And the biggest symbol of this for me, and it's the thing that kind of broke me, I suppose, with that movement, was the kind of attack on wildness and the attack on open lands that's going on now in the name of environmentalism. I mean, I live in the northwest of England, and I spent a lot of my childhood, as I say in the article, on the mountains and on the moors and on the hills, and it's those places that I learned to have experiences with the non-human world, with nature as a whole, with wildness that made me want to protect it. And I see those places now being covered in 500-foot wind turbines and tarmac access roads and pylons and all the rest of it. And I see the seas covered with the same things. And I see people that I thought were on my side arguing for the barraging of estuaries and the covering of open spaces with these huge solar panels and all the rest of it. And the end result of this, as far as I can see, is that we're destroying the environment in order to save the environment. And what it actually comes down to, I think, is because environmentalism has changed in that way, we've allowed ourselves to become a movement of people who cannot see the wood for the trees, almost sometimes quite literally. And I think we're in a period now, a historical period perhaps, where it's impossible to pretend any longer that we're not undergoing a collapse, an environmental collapse, but also a collapse of our assumptions and maybe our industrial system. And it's at this point where it's more important than ever for us to assert those original radical green values. And I don't see that happening across the mainstream of the green movement. So that, I guess, is the case I'm making here.
Great. Thanks, Paul. Eric from Orion Magazine here again. Now, Liera, Keith, would you reflect on the article and relate Paul's thoughts to your own work and your own writings?
Sure. First, I want to say that Paul's essay was one of the most beautiful things I've read in a long time, and I just wish that beauty was enough to save our planet. So 200 species are going to go extinct today, and another 200 will go extinct tomorrow, and then another 200 will go extinct the day after that, and they were my kin. And I am bewildered that environmentalists are no longer telling the truth. So I'm going to quote Paul here. Today's environmentalism is about saving civilization from the results of its own actions. Now, this is not cognitively challenging. There is a political arrangement that's created that feeding frenzy of destruction. And yes, it's called civilization. So the obvious question, well, what is civilization? Well, it just means people living in cities. And what that means is that they need more than the land can give. Okay, they're living in too dense of a population. A great example, of course, would be Manhattan. If you think of that little tiny island, there's no way that's going to support 2 million people. So the food, the water, the energy, they all have to come from somewhere else because the city has used up its own. So from that point forward, it doesn't actually matter what lovely, peaceful, nonviolent values people might hold in their hearts. That society is now dependent on imperialism and genocide because no one willingly gives up their land, their water, their trees. But since the city has used up its own, it has to go out and get those from somewhere else. And that's the last 10,000 years in two sentences. So here's the situation. 98% of the planet's old-growth forests are gone. 99% of the world's prairies are gone. They're simply gone. They've been eradicated. And that is the predictable endpoint of civilization, of human societies that take more than the land can give. They survive by devouring land bases. Civilization is incompatible with life. And we need to say that basic fact as loud as we can, as often as we can. It was a one-time blowout, and it's over, because the planet is now on the verge of complete biotic collapse. We can't have our planet and eat it too. I shouldn't have to say that. It should be obvious at this late stage of the game. But this is a culture of profound entitlement, and it's so profound it doesn't even notice that it's turning the planet to dust. So for the Earth to survive, that living arrangement called civilization, it's going to have to be stopped. And we're going to have to stop that destruction. So all of it, the oil, the coal, the clear cuts, the dams, the entire industrial economy. Now, this could be done using nonviolent direct action, but it would require sustained committed blockades, not symbolic blockades, not those blockades that make a point for a day, but blockades that make a decisive material impact. Okay, we stop the trains carrying the coal, and we can stop the tankers carrying the oil and the pipelines carrying the tar sands. If we love this planet, we stop them. And we also stop telling ourselves fairy tales about wind turbines and solar panels. And if you don't believe me, Google right now. Google rare earth mining and look at the pictures. It's every bit as horrifying as the tar sands and mountaintop removal. Now, as an example, I'd really like to reference the French labor strike that happened in 2010. The protesters blockaded the fuel depots, the oil refineries, and the major oil terminal in France. So in 3 weeks, the whole economy was slowing to a halt for lack of fuel. And the French strikers did what every military and every insurgency does. They interrupted the keynotes of infrastructure. And in this case, it was the energy infrastructure. They were well on their way to shutting down the entire economy, and they did it using nonviolence. So this could be done. The real question is, why aren't we doing it? And I hate that part of the answer is that we're the people who benefit from this repulsive arrangement of power. But some of us intend to start. And you can find out more about the Deep Green Resistance Movement at deepgreenresistance.org at our website. There's also a group called MEND that we could reference, and that's the Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta. The people on the land of the Niger Delta have been devastated by the oil industry, just devastated. And they originally tried nonviolent civil disobedience, and they were all killed by the military. So they moved, they stepped up, and they now do direct actions against the infrastructure itself. And they've been incredibly successful. They've reduced the oil output of Nigeria by a full third, okay, a full third. And there's just a few hundred of them, and that's how successful they've been. So, yes, this can be done. We could stop this economy. So this is the facts as they stand. You know, our planet is actually dying, and she's really being drawn and quartered. There are parts of China right now in which there are no longer any flowering plants, and that's because all the pollinators are dead. But that's 500 million years of evolution that's gone. So that's a complete biotic collapse. We've got to start thinking like a serious resistance movement, because this is a war. I know it feels like daily life because it's been going on for 10,000 years, and the cupboards are full and the lights are on, but this is a war. And honestly, if we were polar bears or black terms, we would know it was a war. So here's a thought experiment. If like evil Nazis had taken over our country and they were destroying the forests and the rivers and they were wiping out 200 species every day and altering the climate itself, I think we would know it was time to fight back. I don't know why ExxonMobil and Monsanto and Cargill get a free pass here. I do know that we need a movement that's brave and smart and militant and means it, because we need warriors who will put themselves between what is left of this planet and fossil fuel. And if you can't be one of those warriors, it's fine. You can be part of the culture of resistance, because resistance movements always need two things. They need loyalty, they need material support, and all of us can do that. If anyone is left to look back 100 years from now, they are going to wonder what was wrong with us that we didn't fight back when our planet was going down. Now, you love something or you wouldn't be listening today. Whatever you love, it is under assault. And love is a verb, which means we've got to let that love call us to action.
Thanks, Liara. Now, David Abram, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, fantastic. Now, David, you're a deep thinker on these issues. What rang true for you in Paul's piece and in Liara's remarks?
Oh, lots and lots. It's a great essay. Pretty incisive in many of its facets. I've never been very at ease or at home with the term environmentalist or even the word environment, since it takes all that multiplicitous weirdness and otherness from spiders to thunderclouds and flattens it all into one thing, the environment, which sets it all in relation to us. The environment means our environment. It overlooks that we're the environment for the tree frogs. So in some ways, it's the problem is set by the term and by the way we understand the very notion of environment. Paul speaks of non-human nature other than human nature, but the wild world that each of us is concerned to protect is not the non-human or the other than human. It's a much more than human world. It's a world that includes us two-legged, but it also exceeds us. And it's the way that it exceeds us that's so necessary. I'm really grateful to this essay for calling us back to that emotional attachment and the sense, Paul's sense of radical astonishment and wonder that we all know, that feeling full passion at finding ourselves inside this outrageously weird and beautiful world in all its multiplicity and bizarreness. Beauty, deep beauty, yeah, the sense of wonder and the fierce love that such beauty inspires. When we trivialize people's sensory attachment to the beauty of their place, to the beauty of the land, wherever they live, if we trivialize that or say, well, that's got to be secondary, because we need to put a wind farm here, we need to at least be aware of that. That is undermining the people's deepest sense of solidarity with the rest of the earth. Sensory perception is like the glue that binds our separate nervous systems into the encompassing ecosystem. Sensory perception, which is all that aesthetics means, it's just a sensory experience, sensory awareness. You can't take these things as being just trivial. I think Paul's essay brings that out in some really important ways. It also very incisively, though in passing, points to how the wind was taken out of the sails of the radical ecology movement precisely at the moment when the computer moved into people's homes and the digital revolution became this much more collective and personalized thing infiltrating our homes, our pockets, our telephones, and everybody fell into this deep thrall with their screens and began to live much, much more in this house of mirrors that isolates us or sort of closes us into a loop with our own signs, sort of short-circuiting the old and instinctive reciprocity between the human body and the animate earth. And Paul's critique of the abstraction and abstractness of the movement today and the way it really is just a continuation of business as usual. How do we preserve or find some way to, you know, keep this civilization rolling? There's so much that's destructive and disastrous about this civilization. Why should we be concerned to keep culture in this form going? What other possibilities are there for culture? But given all of this incisiveness, for me, the essay's power is blunted when, Paul, when you lambast or ridicule the notion that social justice and environmental justice should go hand in hand. I mean, I think they better go hand in hand. Otherwise, there ain't much hope, not just for us humans, but for most other species as well. We just need a much more alive and vitalizing sense of what social justice or societal well-being might look like. What sort of culture is appropriate to a wild biosphere? What does wild culture look like, taste like? What does it feel like? What kind of culture would be appropriate to the high desert where I'm living now? What other very different styles of culture are commensurate with a wild, flourishing coastal estuary or with a healthy and exuberant rainforest? What does wild culture look like? So that's a key question that rose for me in reading the essay. And you know, in response also to what Lierre is so eloquently saying, but my sense is that bringing civilization down by confrontational means, yes, by violent means, I don't know. My sense is that the other side has all the weapons. It's got all the ways and means to just, I can't imagine a more faster, swifter way to bring on a police state reaction than being as full-on confrontational as we could be. So I'm in deep solidarity with my brother and sister in this conversation, but I'm interested more in how we transform or shapeshift or metamorphose this culture. And I think there's lots of possibilities for that to happen because it's just being shoved. It's a necessity that is beginning to bite at the heels and at the noses of every single one of us now.
Thank you, David. Now, Paul or Liara, you want to reflect on any of what's been said to date?
Yeah, I'd like to say a couple of things if I could. I thought both of you are saying necessary and powerful things. David, I'm glad you like the essay because The Thrill of the Sensuous was one of my kind of inspirations for writing it. The one thing I would clear up quickly is the point about environmental justice and social justice. I'm not saying they shouldn't go hand in hand. The point I was making is that I constantly hear this quote from environmentalists that they are the same thing. It's a kind of left-green, it's the sort of left-green standard. You know, they're the same thing. And the point is that they could be the same thing and they should be the same thing, but usually they're not.
Right.
And I think that's it's a kind of excuse that you hear from the sort of the eco left, if you like, very often, is that campaigning for we have to have all the we have basically it's almost as if we have to do the social justice stuff first because otherwise we can't do the other stuff. And I think, but I mean, I'm not suggesting it doesn't matter. It does matter. And I think if you have if you have any kind of horribly unjust world, as we're starting to see now, then it comes apart at the seams anyway, because eventually people take it apart, especially when the resources start running out. I get very conflicted about the what to do question, which of course will come up a lot, I'm sure, fairly soon about this, and we can cover a bit of that later. I kind of share all of Lier's feelings about it, but I also share David's reservations because I just think that if it were there's a novel called Ridley Walker, written by a writer called Russell Hoven, who died recently. Fantastic novel, very strange, written in an odd dialect, which is supposed to be a sort of bastardized version of English. And it's set 1,000 years after a nuclear holocaust in Kent, in England. Brilliant book, I really recommend it. And it's a post-apocalyptic book. It was written about 25 years ago now. And the plot, without giving too much away, revolves around this strange community of people who've almost forgotten everything about civilization except the power to violence that it had. And they spend most of the book looking for something that they vaguely remember in legends. What they're actually looking for is the power to make weapons again. But what they're really looking for, more metaphorically, is the power to rebuild this enormous thing that collapsed, because they have the vague stories about how wonderful it was. And the fear I have is that if the whole thing does collapse swiftly, whether we do it or whether it's done, if we haven't stopped believing in it, we'll try and build it up again. You know what I mean? And that's the problem. And what I can see at the moment, the one thing that does give me some sense of optimism is that this system is cracking so fast now, and so many people are losing faith in it and beginning to see it for what it is. And that doesn't mean they know what the hell to do or whether they can do anything. But I mean, you can see it in every corner of the world, in all sorts of reflections. And the more that happens, the more we lose faith, the easier it is to do something, whatever the something is. But if we have to lose faith in it first. We have to see it not working. And it's interesting. I completely share Lier's sense of outrage, which is, why the hell aren't people seeing this? Why aren't they doing anything? Can you not, you know, look at the figures, look out your window. You can see this stuff. Why aren't you doing it? But the answer is, of course, that we're comfortable. And those of us who aren't comfortable have the promise that they could be comfortable if they join in. And that's so powerful that it's very hard to defeat it. So the only conclusion I've come to really on this stuff at the moment is that if we can stop feeling comfortable with this, it could fall apart quite quickly. Because I think a lot of people know how poisonous it is, but they don't know what to do. I mean, it's a very difficult one, but it's going to be interesting talking about it.
Liara, do you have anything to interject?
You know, the whole thing is a pyramid scheme, and it's been that way for the last 10,000 years. And the planet is being gutted for a tiny percentage of us, and that includes other lands and other peoples. And we can leave them to fight on the front lines while we keep getting all the goodies, or you know, we can say out loud that the poor people are fighting and people of color are fighting and indigenous people are fighting because they're the ones on the front lines. It's their land right now that's being destroyed, so that we can have things like iPhones and, you know, ice cream 24/7 or whatever the hell. And it's just not acceptable to me to let the people of Mend be the only ones who fight, you know, because they're the ones that are knee-deep in oil sludge. And all that's being done for our benefit. Yes, people are very attached to this way of life if they're rich people. I think that the poor, which is most of the people around the planet, would heave a huge sigh of relief if this ended tomorrow. And they would very much like to go back to the life ways that they've known for thousands of years, all of which has been taken from them, so that, you know, we can have this crap. And, you know, we essentially live behind a military barricade. That's what makes that possible. So we can pretend we live these nice nonviolent lives and aren't we all peaceful and friendly, but in fact, you know, in our name and for our benefit, the planet is being gutted. So I can't back away from the necessity for some of us at least to join in solidarity and fight for our planet and also to fight for, you know, the human justice that would ultimately come with that.
All right. Eric from Orion Magazine here again. Mm. If something they've said sparked a question or comment for you, please email it to me at events@orionmagazine.org, or you can use the online chat box, but please keep it as brief as you can. Email is best, though, and the address, again, is events@orionmagazine.org. This event today is free and open to all, and we hope you'll consider supporting it and others in the series by making a gift to Orion, which you can do at orionmagazine.org/donate. Now, we do have a lot of questions coming in, and let's start with Clark. Clark sent a great email that had a letter to the editor of his local paper attached, and it was this letter was signed by 19 sustainability and community groups urging the new mayor of his city to take that city to the next level, they said, with a vision of sustainability and greenness, yet he said nowhere is there any mention of protecting parks or green spaces or rivers or other critical elements. So he wants to know, what can recovering environmentalists do to balance or counter this seemingly inexorable push for sustainability to the exclusion of almost everything else, including saving our remaining nature and wildlands? Now, any of you can take a whack at that. It's not just for Paul or David. It can be any or all of you.
Well, I mean, I suppose it's the thing that's occurred to me and the thing that I tried to write about in the essay and that we talk about quite a lot in the Dark Mountain Project as well, is the fact that, you know, that this stuff is inevitable. This is the system trying to keep itself going. There's an enormous machine. You can call it civilization, industrialism, whatever you want to call it. We all know what it is. And yeah, it's faced with any number of problems, from economic collapse to ecological collapse to peak oil to whatever. And it's going to try and keep itself going through any means necessary. And yeah, that, whether that involves slaughtering the people of the Niger Delta or whether it involves whacking mirrors all across the Sahara Desert, they're going to do that. And if they have to call it sustainability, then they'll call it that. But that's got nothing to do with what we're actually talking about. So in terms of how to counter that, I think the first thing to do is to stop expecting it not to happen. And to stop, you know, being surprised in some ways. I mean, this is the instrumentalism of the machine just doing what it does. And you know, what you do to stop it is you could do anything from putting yourself in the way of it to talking about it differently. I mean, some of this stuff is about language, I find, and we've allowed ourselves as I don't know, environmentalists or whatever we want to call ourselves, to have our language taken away from us in terms of how we talk about this stuff. I mean, this is one of the things that just made me flee from this so rapidly, is that I hear mainstream environmentalists talking like businessmen, talking like economists, pretending to talk like scientists, talking like these kind of dried out technocrats, and obsessing over carbon to the exclusion of all other issues. And if you allow that to happen, if we allow that to happen, then this will be the result. People won't talk about beauty. They won't talk about love. They won't talk about the kind of solidarity with the rest of life that David was talking about. And you know, if we just sit here silently doing nothing and saying nothing in our own words, then this stuff will just march all over the place. And I think that as things start to fall apart, which they're doing, it will just become more and more desperate, and there'll be more of this, and a new way of seeing, a new way of talking, or maybe a very old one, would make a difference, I think.
Nancy's dialed in through the webinar platform, and she says, well, but what about recent efforts like 350.org fighting the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline? And, of course, it looks like today, as a side note, President Obama might be caving in on that. But she goes on, are they, we, me, misguided that this is an ineffective strategy, or do we just need dozens and hundreds of more efforts like these?
I would say that it's a good beginning, and clearly those people are working really tirelessly, so I'm certainly not going to criticize them, because we need action sort of at every level of the spectrum. And so I think mostly what 350.org at this point, what they've been really good at is raising public awareness and a certain amount of witnessing. So that kind of symbolic arrest at the White House is a form of witnessing. But we need to step it up. And that means that we need to be using civil disobedience in the way that it's meant to be used. And that is actually to obstruct something, to actually put your body in the way of the harm that's happening. And so that's why, you know, like at Deep Green Resistance, we're having a whole summer of campaigns. We actually intend to shut down an oil refinery, and we need to show people how civil disobedience should be done. It's like one of our best techniques for political change, and it's been gutted over the last 30 years, and I don't really understand it. I mean, people used to know how to do civil disobedience, and it's been turned into this very bizarre symbolic act now. It's not meant to be symbolic. It's meant to actually obstruct, because you're using bodies instead of weapons, right? But you need to stop something bad that's happening. And so that's what we intend to do. And I would really encourage people to read about the history of civil disobedience and the ways that it's been used. Gene Sharp, you know, is the main theorist of civil disobedience as a, you know, a form of direct action. But we need to think like real strategists. And to me, the main division is not between, say, violence and nonviolence. It's really between people who are willing to do something and people who are willing to do nothing. So people who are willing to face down power, and people who will buckle and will not face down power. And that's really the main division. I mean, from there, it's all just a matter of tactics. And you look at what you've got, and you look at what you're up against, and you decide whether you have what it takes to use civil disobedience correctly. But again, that main division is not between, you know, violence and nonviolence. It really is between confronting power or submitting to power. So, you know, 350.org is doing what they do, but we need the people who are going to be the front line resistance and actually put themselves in harm's way.
I would just agree with that wholeheartedly. Yeah, I think 350 is doing some great work. Of course, it's darn useful. We just need gobs and gobs and gobs of other approaches being put to work as well.
Now, Bob has written in by email and says, does Paul Kingsnorth or the others for that matter feel that in the alliance between the Occupy movement and things like 350.org, the climate change message will be lost in the social justice agenda of the left? Or is there hope of a genuine realignment of the political beast to include eco-justice as a primary value, as Naomi Klein recently argued in The Nation?
That's a good question. I mean, I think it's interesting this. I wrote a book 10 years ago called One No Many Yeses, which was all about global social justice movements, actually, which is just, it's strange because this was at the time of Seattle and the few years after that where the equivalent of the Occupy movement went all around the world. And then it disappeared in the war on terror and the new crackdowns on activists and all the rest of it.
Right.
And now it's coming back again. And the reason it's coming back again in the West, in places like the States, in places like Britain, is that we're being squeezed in the way that the poor have been squeezed for the last 40 years. Stuff like this has been going on across the so-called third world for quite a long time, you know, pretty much in every country in Latin America for 20 years. And it's going on here now because we can see the injustice in our own countries, and we can see the injustice growing and the inequality growing, and we're losing our public services and all the rest of it. Now, that's a slightly different issue to the one we're talking about, which is not to say that they have to be separate and all the rest of it, and they can't be connected. But this stuff is primarily about how this model of civilization is falling apart and how we're taking the fallout, and we want to stop that happening, which is perfectly good and legitimate. But I think it's a slightly different thing. And, of course, this is the point I was trying to make in the essay, maybe clumsily, about social justice and environmental justice and how they should go hand in hand, but they often don't. It'd be very easy to envisage a world in which we had maybe equality and social justice and virtually everything that wasn't human was dead. And this is, you know, this is the paradox. It is why you have to try and work these things out. But I mean, I don't know. I think I see this as a. I mean, I also think, by the way, that the climate change message has actually crowded out all other so-called environmental messages, and that's one of the problems. Actually, I mean, we've got so obsessed with climate change because it's the biggest threat to the system, and it's the biggest threat to our lives, and it's very symbolic and it's very real. And, you know, almost everything that you hear about now, when you hear the word environmentalism, will be a discussion about reducing emissions in some way, as if that were the only thing to concern ourselves with, as if that were the only environmental threat, and as if the only solution to it was a technological one about what machines we can invent to get us out of the mess. So I think that, I have concerns about the so-called climate justice movement anyway, because I think it's missing a lot of the points. I don't think it's surprising, because we live in such a sort of narcissistic techno-industrial society that we can't see outside it, and that's the stuff that David touches on. But I don't know. I think that we're just undergoing a collapse at the moment, and we have to try and keep this stuff in mind, because the thing that worries me, of course, is that when we're going through a collapse as humans, as individuals, we'll focus on ourselves and what we need and what we want and what we want to prevent for ourselves from losing. And that's a time when it's very easy to lose sight of anything that doesn't immediately affect you.
Yeah, and the other thing, or I guess what you're implying about climate change as such a single overarching issue, is that, well, it's mighty global, and so it takes attention and everybody's focus away from their visceral engagement with the earth immediately around them, with the specific particulars, the critters, the losses of particular animals, and losses of habitat right here, what's happening to the soil. And it's also so abstract. It's a language of statistics and chemistry that we're all speaking, that also steals us away, or, you know, slides us away from our direct experience, our felt encounter with what really gets us in the gut. And I hear that. I want to say one thing, though, in response to this question of social justice. I mean, we know we're heading into, we're already living in a time of mounting cataclysms, and things are going to get yet really hard and harder and then harder and then harder still and fairly rapidly. It seems to me the easiest human reaction to such hardship is to start looking for somebody to blame and try to hurt them or destroy them, or make them feel pain. You know, the scapegoat impulse. And we've seen so much evidence for this in the bloody century that's just passed. I'm really concerned with how to short circuit that impulse. And I'm actually pretty darn glad that some real social reflection and Marxist analysis too began to infiltrate the ecological movement, because I think we really needed to begin to include human beings and human communities deeply within our understanding of the wild biosphere. But what the left is needing to understand and to begin to understand a lot more is just how profoundly human well-being and human justice is dependent upon the exuberant and, you know, wild flourishing of the local earth and of other animals, of the wetlands and the woods. I think we're human only in contact with what is not human, by which I mean, you know, we are human and humane only in contact and conviviality with what ain't human.
That's a really interesting point.
I'll leave it there.
I want to just add something about the Occupy movement as well. I mean, if we understand what capitalism is, it's a system that takes living creatures and their homes and it declares them private property, and then it turns them into dead commodities, and then it accumulates those commodities into wealth. So this is a pyramid scheme of death. And I think that's self-evident that, you know, capitalism is the 1% taking from the 99%. But we have to add to that, you know, 98% of the world's old growth forests are gone, and 99% of the prairies are gone. And that means 99% of the Pask flowers and 99% of the prairie dogs and 99% of the bison. The wealth is created from their dead bodies. The point is not to redistribute that wealth. The point is to stop the death while there's still something left alive.
Sure.
And I think that that is a real, that's a real division point in the Occupy movement. And that's going to be true of any broad-based social movement. You're going to have people who pull to the center and then people who pull to way more radical perspectives. And right now, as long as they're just protesting that they've lost some of their middle-class entitlements, they just want to redistribute the wealth. But I want the more radical side to win, which is to say it's not about redistributing that wealth. It's about stopping that wealth, which is to say it's about stopping the death.
Well, Nancy has piped up, and she says, oh, was it Nancy? No, it was Caroline. Caroline says, now, David has come closest to my observation in this talk about transformation, shape-shifting, morphing culture, and I wonder why I haven't yet heard the word sacred. When did sacred become a dirty word? Is the ecology movement did once have a spiritual thread, like with Thoreau, Muir, and Leopold. It's a spiritual depth that's transformative. So what of this word, you guys? What do you make of sacred in context of this movement?
I'm sure David can talk about it better than me, so I'll just briefly say that I think that word disappeared when we all started pretending to be very serious in relation to the stuff we were just saying about how climate change and the sort of these particular technocratic approaches colonized the movement. If you decide that climate change is the problem and you've got to get that sorted with policy and technological fixes pretty quickly, then you better put a suit on and start talking to the movers and shakers, and you better stop talking about the sacred, because they're not going to listen to you. And you know, that's it's an example of the colonizing of language, I think, to some degree. If you want to walk with the power brokers, if you want to walk with the guys to get things done, you can't talk like that, because they just laugh at you. That's my observation anyway.
I don't have much to say on that, except it seems to me that that's what, you know, whether or not we're using the term, that's what each of us is speaking of here, and it's very much what I hear in Lierre's comments. She's speaking very directly from the sense of the sacred. I can't help but hear it that way. And when you're willing to put your body on the line, your life on the line, it's because of your sense of something sacred that is being violated in a horrific way. And I think that's what we're all on about here.
Now, how about Hugh? He wants to know, do you imagine a graceful way forward as opposed to a path of total collapse in a world of struggle among the survivors? Doesn't sound like a pleasant scenario. Except from a reduced capacity of humans to degrade systems, David referred to a transformation of culture. So what of that? Is there a graceful way forward? Anyone? Thoughts on that?
Personally, I very much doubt it. I think if you're looking for pleasant scenarios at this point in time, you're going to be disappointed. I think that it's impossible to predict what's going to happen, but we know, as David just said, that we're already in a kind of unraveling here. Things are already collapsing. We can see that. Lots of us are still in denial about it, but we won't be able to be for much longer. So we have to sort of pick our way through that. I think that one of the problems I keep coming across is not necessarily with this question, but with others, is that people seem to think that there has to be a solution to every problem. It just has to be because we want there to be. And secondly, that we have to have a sort of global approach. There has to be a global plan so that we can, you know, we can stop things, stop bad things happening, and make it global and roll it out. And I just, you know, it's not going to happen. So we have to focus in on what we can do most effectively given that. And that's not the same thing as giving up at all. It's almost the opposite of giving up, actually. The only thing it's giving up on is a sort of false hope, as far as I see it. But yeah, it's there's no easy way out of it for me. I don't think that it's going to be an easy century at all. We're all going to have to live through. And I think those of us, it's interesting. Some people say, well, we live in the rich world and we're going to be shielded from it better than the poor. I'm not sure that's necessarily true, actually. I think that we live in a lot of us in cultures like this live in quite profound isolation from each other. we have very few actual practical skills. We're entirely dependent on the machine to get our food and our energy and everything else. If that starts falling apart in any way, we're in big trouble very quickly. So I actually don't believe that any of us is going to escape some great difficulties, which will make us open our eyes if we haven't opened them yet.
And it does. I mean, all the ways in which the system is cracking and springing leaks and breaking down, they'll open the way for all sorts of other possibilities
to
come trickling in or flooding in. I think we know very little about what is possible. I don't think it's going to be very graceful. I don't think I think it's going to be clumsy and mighty ugly, inevitably in many facets. But I take that last question as a question about how we work to stop this thing. And it's a big question that I have, because when we ask people to now, you know, come in, when we put out a call for warriors and we say, this is a war, and if you feel yourself as a warrior, that's powerful, and likely to bring in a lot of good folk, but I think it's also likely to bring on board a lot of folks who join the effort for their own meanness or their own unmetabolized anger, and they just want to destroy stuff. And I don't have a lot of faith that can really be put to good use. It seems much more likely to bring on the kinds of internecine violence that would both ravage the human world, but deeply ravage the more than human terrain alongside, and just, you know, fill it with blood. So it's a question, a sincere question, Lear.
I guess I feel like it's already filled with blood. That, you know, when another day goes by and there's 200 species gone, I don't know how much worse it could get. The culture is completely destroying every last living thing, and they're not going to stop till it's all dead. The soil is going to be baked of bacteria by the time this is over if we don't stop it. So I guess I just don't feel the same reservations. We need to stop this. There's, you know, the plankton populations are collapsing in the ocean, and I guess plankton are too small and green for most people to care about, but I'll tell you that 2 out of 3 animal breaths is made possible by the oxygen that they produce. So if the oceans go down, we're going down too. And that's what I mean when I say every last living thing. They're not going to stop till it's all over. But, you know, where I see a lot of, I guess the only place where I really draw more inspiration is from the fact that the world will repair itself if we just get out of the way. And, I mean, they're scrambling around out there trying to come up with all these technological fixes, but frankly, the world will repair itself if we just stop destroying. And, you know, my favorite statistic on this is that if we could repair the grasslands the world over, even 75% of the world's rangelands, which have been destroyed by agriculture, let's be very clear, but if we could restore them to prairie, it would only take about 15 years, and the carbon would be down to 233 parts per million, which is way below that, I'm sorry, 323, that's way below that 350 mark, and it would only take 15 years. And that's how good, you know, grass is at building soil. Mm, of course, the building block is carbon. Yeah. So all we have to do is stop destroying. I mean, the world wants to be a grassland, and it wants to be a forest, and it really wants to be a wetland, and we could help that process happen quicker, but honestly, if we just get out of the way, it will happen. And we could sequester all that carbon. You know, we don't have to go through this next century of hell. So the solutions are actually, you know, just for us to stop being these sort of monstrous creatures that civilization has created. I mean, we lived on this planet for 4 million years and we didn't destroy things. So it's really only 7 places where civilization began. And, you know, I get that it's now the dominant system, but we know other ways to be. And there are still people alive today who have held on to their cultures and know better ways. And I'm sure they'll teach us if we ask them humbly. So that part doesn't actually concern me. It's just, I think we have to stop this machine. And I don't, I just,
I think we're in deep, in deep agreement on many aspects of this. It's just how most effectively, strategically, tactically, to stop it. And if one really applies violence to this incredibly violent system, whether that doesn't, in fact, stop it, but just sets up a snowballing violence, whether there might be yet more strategic ways of morphing it, shape-shifting it. And I know you, just from things you've said in this conversation, clearly support widespread nonviolent civil disobedience. I think there's ever more possibilities suddenly for that opened up by the Occupy movement. And I just think if we have in our minds the vision of just bringing something to a halt through some sort of violent breakdown, I don't think that's a real, it's just to me, I've not seen any evidence in my life that, you know, the sudden stoppage of any force actually brings a kind of quietude afterwards. I'm more given to a logic of metamorphosis, I guess. I can't help it. My background is that of a magician. I think that there is a logic to the world very different from that to which we've been educated, it's not entirely rational, that's for sure. I think that nature or this breathing biosphere lives and moves by a logic that does not move by straight lines and right angles, and goes through dramatic shape or phase shifts at certain moments when they, when one least expects it. Again, I don't think we know all that much about what's possible.
Well, let me bring this back around to Paul Kingsnorth with the last question. And it, Paul, it concerns the last two paragraphs of your article, which, you know, people reacted to very in many ways. So Douglas wants to know, Paul, can you please speak more about your last two paragraphs where you say, I withdraw from the campaigning and the marching?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting this. It's been a while since I wrote this piece, so I did withdraw actually for quite a long time, and I'm still quite withdrawn from it. And what I mean by that is that I've withdrawn from the kind of stuff that I used to do. I've withdrawn from all of the sort of lobbying and the campaigning to stop climate change and all of the kind of mainstream stuff that we've been talking about here, because I don't think it works. And a lot of people said to me, particularly all the environmentalists who are still at it, who felt attacked by that, unsurprisingly, well, you're just giving up then. And, you know, what use is that? You're giving up. And I said, I'm not giving up, except in the sense that I'm giving up on stuff that doesn't work. And I think it doesn't work because I've been doing it for 15 years, and I don't think we've got hope of making it work. So it's the withdrawal. It was really, for me, a sense of going out and going in and trying to think about what I was doing, going back to first principles. Which comes down to a lot of the stuff that David has said here, which I think is so important, because another criticism I got from this essay is, oh, you know, this is just romantic. What's all this? What use is all this romantic nonsense about how beautiful hills are? You know, we haven't got time for that. We've got to save the world. And I think, as David says, if you don't have a passion for life in whatever form that comes to you, whether it's through a love of the hills that you're walking on, or the tree outside your window, or this sense of a great web of species that's disappearing, whatever it is, if you don't have a felt, sensuous, emotional attachment to something, then I don't think you're going to have any concern for it or love for it at all. I think that's where all of it starts, or should start. And I think if you've got any kind of environmental movement that doesn't start from that place, that just starts from a dry analysis of numbers, then you're in big trouble, and that's what we've ended up with. So the sense of withdrawal, which I have gone through, and which actually led me to start up the Dark Mountain Project, which is a kind of cultural and literary response to ecocide and collapse, was a sense of, as I say, going back to first principles. What is this about? Well, this is about what all of us have been talking about here. We've got this huge web of incredible life, and we're destroying it all. And what are we going to do about that? How are we going to live through it? How are we going to stop it if we can? And the answers to that will be different for all of us, depending on what we're good at and what we believe we can do and what our strengths are. But there's no it isn't a turning away from it, because none of us can afford to do that in whatever we're good at. What we can't afford to do is turn away from all of the things that we've been talking about here, this great ecocide. We've got to face it down, whatever emotions it brings to us, and go through and try and play our part in stopping it in whatever way we can.
Thanks. Well, we ought to begin to wrap up now. We're on the hour mark. Any further thoughts, Liara and David, to share with us?
I would just like to end by quoting Frederick Douglass, who's one of my favorite people from history. And he said, power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has, and it never will.
Yeah, and I'd just like to say what a pleasure it is to be on the phone with, you know, really splendid souls who actually give a shit and actually...
That's always nice, isn't it?
Yeah, and who aren't afraid to stare hell in the face, and that's a darn good first step. And let's move. Yeah.
Paul, anything to leave us with?
Yeah, I mean, what I would say is that I think in a strange way I'm more hopeful than I was when I wrote this piece. I mean, it fluctuates day by day depending on what I've seen, you know, as I'm sure it does for all of us. But the hope for me comes from the fact that, as David was alluding to as well, this, everything's splintering now. The system's falling apart in all sorts of different ways. We're going through a huge, huge change that we can only barely begin to comprehend. And we see, you know, parts of it in our everyday life, in the way that our economies are contracting or falling apart. But it's so much bigger than that. I mean, I think that just even if you do isolate climate change and talk about that, the Earth appears to be moving to a new state, and it's probably too late to stop it. And it's done it many times before in its history. And if that's the case, we're going to have to move with it in some way. But what we're not going to be able to take with us is this whole huge industrial edifice that we've built up. So I don't think it's even an option to imagine that that will last too much longer. And what its end will look like and how long it will last, I don't know. But we're clearly in this time of huge change. And when that happens, when the cracks appear, all sorts of things start growing through them. And I think it's true, actually, that we don't know what the possibilities will be. And I don't think that means we should go away feeling smug and thinking that everything will be fine, because it won't be. It will be very far from fine. But I think there are probably going to be possibilities to change this thing that we haven't seen yet. I feel like we're kind of in between two paradigms at the moment, and we don't quite know what the new one's going to be. So it's probably good for us all to remain alert and just keep talking about this stuff, and keep doing what we're all doing and what everyone listening will be doing as well, because it's just, you know, it's too important not to, I think.
Mm. Fantastic. Thank you. Now, Orion's live web events are made possible by subscriptions to Orion and by your donations, so please go to orionmagazine.org/donate to support our efforts to bring people together for conversations like this one. Please check back later tomorrow or Friday for the audio recording of today's discussion. If you want to hear it again, hear parts of it again, share it with a friend, find that at orionmagazine.org/multimedia. Thanks very much, Paul, Liara, and David, for your thoughts today. Thanks to everyone on the line with us for sharing your time.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks much.
Yeah, it's been great.
Great. Well, have a great rest of your week, everyone. This is Eric Hoffner of Orion Magazine signing off. Take care. Keep in touch.